job.
Hi, everybody. My name's Denny, and I'm an alcoholic. I'll bet you can all hear me, huh? That's the best news I got for you tonight. What a rare honor this is. Akron, the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, here comes the hard part for me. I have to thank some people. And the first person I want to thank, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, for taking that meeting with Bill W., that's why we're all here tonight. I'm going to get weepy here, so... next, I want to thank the old-timers. I really want to thank you old-timers that carried this torch and kept AA the same all of these years, these many years. Thank you, guys. Of course, I have to thank my friend Tom and the committee for inviting me. I was here last year. It was one of the thrills of my life. It really was. I've had a lot of big thrills in my life. This beats them all right here. I love being here with you guys. I got to thank Gail L. for showing me around Bob's house and showing me the love and the friendship that she has. I want to thank my friend Don for coming out, a sponsee of mine. We walked the path together, and I'm so just proud of this guy and what he's found here. I know that you've all found that, you know, or we wouldn't be here Friday night. We'd be getting ready, teed up for Saturday night, you know. Just imagine if we were all drunk someplace at the same time. So I'm a very, very grateful alcoholic, and it's only through a loving God that I found here. It's all about the loving God, and I learned the God of my understanding through great sponsorship. My first sponsor was a man named Scott Redman. Some of you knew Scott. Yes? Oh, thank you, thank you. Scott, it was yesterday that Scott passed away, 11 years ago. But he died June 6th, and we put him in the ground on June 10th, AA's birthday. How much better does it get? I still can't talk about that man without getting emotional. He handed me the program on a silver platter. You know, and through Scott, the last years of his life, he was sponsored by Dr. Paul O., another Ohioan. And Dr. Paul was my grand sponsor. I got to know him really well, and he was a very important part of my sobriety. And I got to play, my sponsor, present-day sponsor, is a man named Steve A. in Los Angeles. And through him, I got to meet Sandy Beach and Bob, and all my favorite Pete Bob Bazans, I should finish his name. But, I was blessed with the sobriety that I found here. This is a disease that wants us in the gutter with its foot on our neck, squeezing the life out of us in front of everyone that loves us. And what this program does is this. We're all here, happy, joyous, and free. That's a pretty good deal. Now, my sobriety date is January the 2nd, 1991. So I just celebrated 28 years. Thank you. It's the only place where you get applause for running out of a burning building, you know. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's only one person happier than I am that I'm sober. That's my wife. I've been married to the same girl for 52 years. So a big thank you out to my wife, Monique. She's French. She hasn't figured this out yet, or she would have left a long time ago. No. No, she married one guy, then another guy showed up, then another guy. Then I gave her back the guy that she married in the first place through you people and Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's a wonderful thing, you know. But, you know, if you're sober 28 years but married 52 years, it leaves 24 years unaccounted for. Some of those were pretty good, some were pretty bad, some got rained out, and some should have never been scheduled, you know. I'm glad she stuck it out, you know. Let me tell you a little bit about my, you know, our stories. Everybody in here is probably the most powerful possession that we have. They're all a little different, but powerful? Wow. Why do you think Bill Wilson had to talk to Dr. Bob? And he didn't tell him, you should stop drinking, guy, you know. We share our stories, what it was like, and we get through. Nobody talks to another alcoholic like another alcoholic. So anyway, let me start with, I'm a kid from Eastern Pennsylvania, not too far from here, between Allentown and Stroudsburg, but call it Poconos, you know. And all right, we got some Pennsy. I want to give a quick shout out to the Johnny Mac and the crew out there from Nashville too. Johnny Mac and I closed out the 2000 Minnesota convention with a song he wrote for the convention called "Like We Were Made of Gold," and it was a very special moment in my life. So I have a lot of dear friends here in this place tonight, and it's all through drinking a little too much and finally surrendering. So let me tell you a little bit how it went. My family, Eastern Pennsylvania, no alcoholism. I did this all myself. I'm pretty good at it too. But it took a long time to come on, and that's what I like to talk about. My dad, I never saw him drunk. He'd have some weird thing called Drambuie. You know, I bought him a bottle once when I was in Europe, and I brought him a bottle of Drambuie. I guess it's a Scotch liqueur or something. And he said, "Oh, that's great." And 5 years later, you'll get a kick out of this. We had an old television where the television broke, so that was the liquor cabinet in the basement. You know, we were really rich, I'll tell you. But that bottle of Drambuie was in there with a couple other open bottles that were sitting there. And I said, "Are you going to drink that thing?" He said, "Yeah, I'll get around to it." So I did. You know, I didn't even know what it was or if I liked it, but I drank it. My grandfather, he used to like to have a shot and a beer once in a while. But I never saw him drunk. Not like I used to get drunk. And my family was deeply immersed in our church. My mother was a church secretary, my father a deacon, my grandfather an elder, my sister, brother, grandmother all sang on the church choir. Best I could do was to steal money out of the collection plate. I should tell you that I'm a musician by trade, if you don't already know, but when I was 13, I was working the gin mills at night, you know. So I'd get home 2:30, 3:30 in the morning, and I had 13 years of perfect attendance in Sunday school and church. They give you a big round badge and then a bar under for each year. So I used to walk with a little list. But I found that if I got the gig of gathering up the seventh tradition in the Sunday school, I'd take the collection down to the church office, and sometimes I would steal a quarter, and I'd go across the street, I'd have a smoke and a Coke, and wait for the thing to be over. And then I'd have to sit in the back of the church with my granddad in case he fell asleep. If he went down to the American Legion home, and every couple times a year, he'd go down to the American Legion home and have a shot and a beer. You knew that he was going to fall asleep after that, so. When Granddad would start snoring, the choir loft would come to life, and they'd say, "Wake him up, wake him up, wake him up." And that was my job, to keep Granddad alive. I was a fun kid, a little different because of the music, I must say, but I had that much fun in the 11th grade They asked me to stay another year and show the other kids coming up how to have that much fun, you know. And I did. It slowed my process down a little bit. And this was, I got out of school finally around the time of Vietnam, and I was about to be drafted. So I thought, well, let me put this music to good use. And I heard about the Navy School of Music program in Washington, D.C. I qualified for it, and I joined the Navy. Now back home, we did innocent drinking, like on a Friday night. We'd go get a couple of quarts of beer, go out in the woods, and guzzle them down, and go to the Friday night dance, and usually throw up on the girls there, you know. And I didn't do this very often. I just didn't like the idea of it at all. But, you know, and when in my hometown, the people that lived there and worked there all worked in the Bethlehem steel mills or the anthracite coal mines. These were hard-working people, a lot of ethnicities, and they were tavern drinkers. So my tavern, you could get, if you had, well, for 35 cents, you got a shot of Christian Brothers brandy and a short beer. If you had another 15 cents in your pocket, they'd give you a slice of hot bologna and a hard-boiled egg pickled in red beet juice. After that, you had enough gas to fly to Cleveland, you know. But after, you know, for $5, you could lose your car. And I did occasionally, you know, but alcohol was just fun. I never got, there was no consequences from when the few times that I drank. Now I get into the Navy, and they send me down to South America with a cream-of-the-crop school band. And we're supposed to go down there on an information tour where we're promoting goodwill to our friends in South America. You slap a white Navy suit on a kid, send him out at sea for a couple of weeks, and then cut him loose in a foreign country. We promoted some goodwill, I'll tell you. And you know, down there I learned how to drink some vino tinto and some vino rojo and some pisco sours and all this. So I'm just broadening my horizons, you know, coming out of that small town thinking. And my last job in the Navy, I was stationed in the south of France, taxpayer money going to good use. And we were on the Admiral with the 6th Fleet ship. We used to get up in the morning, go to the fantail, the back of the boat, and play the Star Spangled Banner and raise the flag. And it used to wake the tourists up in the fancy hotels. So they asked the Admiral if we could not make that noise in the morning. I'm on vacation. So he said, all right, you guys can have 4 days off at a time. So we all pooled our money, got some really crappy apartment. We had civilian clothes, and we just have to come back to the ship every 4 days to buy another carton of cigarettes for $1 and a bottle of Chivas Regal 12-year-old for $3. I was living large. And now I'm drinking Chateau Neuf du Pape and some Louis Saint-Georges, all that French stuff, you know. I met my wife while I was stationed there. She didn't know I was in the Navy. So we fell in love, and it came time for my hitch was up. They were going to send me home, and we'd gotten engaged. So I said, well, you know, in 2 weeks I'm going home, going back to the States. She goes, what? We just got engaged. I said, yeah, I'm in the Navy. You're in the Navy? So I went home, we got our paperwork together, we came over, and we got married November the 26th, 1966. And a couple of those years were real good. I must say. No, they were all great. They were all great. I wouldn't change a thing in it. But it was time to start a career, and I went into New York City to start my career. And it was really such a delusion, because I went into the city and I met all my heroes, the guys that I heard on records and everything. And it was really a disillusion, because when I met these heroes, they all had needles hanging out of their arms, and they were so drunk they could hardly talk. And I said to myself, wow, if that's what you have to do to make that kind of music, where do I go to get some, you know? So I was kind of off and running. But I got this gig in a famous old jazz club where you didn't make a lot of money, but you played with the masters, And the visibility of being there started the studio calls. So now we would start, I'm talking 1967, 68. So now I'm going to work. I'm working till 3:30 in the morning, six nights a week. And then they'd start TV commercials and radio commercials at 9 o'clock in the morning. So it took some preparing to get ready for this stuff, but we'd show up at work and the ad agency guys would have booze there for us. You know, and then in the afternoon we'd go to the record date sessions from 2 to 5 and 7 to 10. We were making records and the record company guys brought more booze and sometimes some other stuff too. We won't talk about that. You know us musicians. But, you know, I thought it was part of the pay, so I made sure to get my share. But by the afternoon record date sessions, half of us were pie-eyed already, you know. And we were making records in those days that are still being played on the radio today. And half of us weren't even there, you know. So it was quite a treat, and I'm doing really well in my profession. Things are going really well. This guy from England comes to town. He was just in probably the biggest band in history. Now, this doesn't get any bigger, this guy. And he looked at maybe 10 or 12 of the guys that were doing the best work in New York at the time, making all the records. And he looked at me, and we had a good time. We had a few laughs, played for him. He liked my attitude, my playing, and hired me to do a record with him. So now, my career doesn't get any better than this. It just cannot get any better than this. So we start doing this record. It's a very special record. Everybody's talking about it in town. My life is sweet. The record comes out, goes right to number one. Right now, my price just went up. It was a magical time in New York. So about 3 months after the record's out and it's still in the top of the charts, he calls me up and said, "Would you like to come to England? Just bring your wife and have a vacation." I thought, wow, that's a good idea. So here's where the mistake starts happening. So we go over to England, actually in Scotland at his farm, and we're just hanging out, having some fun, and he said, "I miss my old band. Do you want to join a band?" All I heard was a cash register, you know, this guy's major. So I'm thinking, oh, a band with this guy, that takes care of my financial needs forever. And doesn't get any better than this. So without thinking, it's the first time I didn't realize at the time, but I have an alcoholic brain. Are there any people out here in their first year of sobriety? All right, yeah. Good. Congratulations. I want to tell you something, though. If you have an alcoholic brain, just don't use it for a little while. Just give us a chance. We'll just shape that puppy up a little bit, you know. So I didn't know that I had an alcoholic brain. So the other mistake was when we put this band together, this fella said, "Of course you'll be a part owner of the band." And we consummated that agreement on what we call the hippie handshake. It was done. Unfortunately, it was done at the time. Big mistake. Hippie handshake. So we sell everything in New York, get rid of all of our stuff in New York City, move to London, start playing with the band, making records, doing tours, sold out tours, the records are selling millions of copies. But all of a sudden, the money, the old Reagan trickle-down effect, there was no trickle. And we were all waiting for some money to come in, you know, so this, I stuck it out 3 or 4 years, I would say. And the guys were coming over to my place after we'd work one day in the studio or whatever, and we'd be complaining. And the drinking started to change. It was no longer some fun. Yeah, let's have a couple drinks. Right now, the alcohol is making its way into the situation. Alcohol gets in the situation, it makes it worse every time. So, I hear a bad piece of information about how the band is being treated, and I say to myself, well, I can't do this anymore. And then the alcoholic brain started screaming at me, it's just leave. Just leave. And I listened to the alcoholic brain. Rather than sit the man down and say, we need a contract, da da da, I didn't do any of that stuff. I listened to the alcoholic brain, who was now taking over my mind. And I made a decision that night to leave that kicked off my alcoholism. My alcoholism started that very night with one phone call. I picked up the phone and I told my boss, I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. Bang. Slam dunked him. We were leaving. There was a car in front of our place in London to take us to the airport to fly to Lagos, Nigeria, to make his biggest selling record. That phone call was probably the most important phone call I ever made in my life. Because after that, every drink that I took, I drank at him. No more fun. I'll show you. I'll kill myself. Slowly. The brilliant mind of the alcoholic. So here, I mean, now I don't know what to do. I'm in a dilemma. And the alcoholic brain just keeps hollering at you, man. Let's get out of here. Let's go back to the States. I didn't want to go back to the rat race in New York. I said to my wife, I said, let's try California. California has that big orchestras that pay the play for the movies, you know, the soundtrack movie scores and all that. I said, I want to do that. So we come to California. California music business says to me, hey, who the hell are you? And who sent for you anyway? Now I got two resentments. So what do you do when you get a resentment? Well, you've heard, resentment is like taking poison and expecting someone else to die. So I started drinking, and my wife started working. And I was a bar drinker. I couldn't wait to get up to my bar, 10:40 in the morning. Like, 10:40? What bar opens at 10:40? So, and I couldn't wait. I'd have a burrito in hand, and I'd go up and have beers and burritos till noon. I wanted to be drinking the hard stuff by noon, so I wasn't feeling what I was feeling. I felt I'm a big loser here and didn't know what to do with my life. Alcohol has taken a turn. It's taken a serious turn now. My wife starts working. She started as a secretary or receptionist secretary, worked her way up to vice president of the Wells Fargo Bank Construction Lending Unit. 30 years carrying a drunk like me. I told you, it's not a very happy story. When alcohol became my master, it was all I can do. It was all I could do to just maintain on a daily basis. It's not pretty. So she realized that if she stayed a little later at work, she would come home and find me blacked out on the couch. That was the end of a perfect day for her, to not have to deal with me. I'd wake up from my blackout 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and I'd slither into bed trying not to wake her up. Of course, she always woke up. Then at 5:30 in the morning, she would get up to get dressed and go to work. And I could never figure out how a woman could make so much noise just getting dressed in the morning, you know. And it was just enough to wake my sorry butt up. She'd give me that look. I know some of you guys in here have seen that look. I didn't want to live like this, but I didn't know how not to. So now I say, I think I got a problem with alcohol. So I go to my family doctor. I had a family doctor that was a musician, Ralph. He played the string bass, you know, boom, 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 boom. So he saw a lot of the musicians in town, and I say, hey, Ralph, I think I have a problem with alcohol. So Ralph says to me, well, if you truly have a problem with alcohol, there's only one thing that works, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what else you got? Come on, I lived in France. I know the difference between cognac and Chateau Neuf de Pape. So I tried hypnosis. It works for a little while. You feel a little self-esteem come back. But this disease keeps talking to you. You don't have a disease. It'll be different this time. Come on, you can drink. You can drink like a gentleman. Next, I tried acupuncture. Brilliant mind of the alcoholic. And I realized, you know, I used to drink at this bar. There was a little comedian who actually became my Eskimo to this program. His name was Sandy, and he used to drink red wine, pineapple juice, and coffee. Yeah, awful. Red wine for the buzz, pineapple juice to stay healthy, and coffee to stay awake, you know. So Sandy had taken one of those three drinks out of the picture. It was just pineapple juice and coffee. He's still hanging out at the bar. I said, what happened? He said, oh, I'm going to those AA meetings. I went, oh. So I watched him for a while. You know, we have to watch, make sure it's okay. And I saw that he was doing okay, and he was happier than he was, and he had less problems. So I said, maybe I'll ask him to go along. So I, hey, man, would you take me to one of those AA meetings? And he did. I went to the AA meeting on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. There's the Comedy Store, and they had a Wednesday 5 o'clock rush hour meeting. And I got to say, this is all about alcohol here, but every once in a while I'd smoke a joint because it made speakers funnier. I'd smoke one on the way in, have one rolled for the way out. Just made the speakers easier to take, you know. But I started to go one meeting a week, and I loved it. I just loved it. I took a food commitment immediately. I'm showing up, man. I'm showing up, damn it. And I loved the meetings. I loved the fellowship. I felt like we all feel when we come to Akron. I felt like I was at home. Hallelujah for AA. And I took a, you know, I'm still doing that, fooling around with that other junk. So I took a dirty 30, 60, and 90 days. And in that time period, I heard, no, it's everything from the neck up. So I realized I had to start over. And January was coming up, New Year's Eve. I worked with a band. And I said, well, I'm going to blow it all out and get ready for January the 2nd. My sobriety date is also my grandmother's birthday. I thought, what a great day to be sober. So I did it for me, but I also did it for her. So New Year's Eve, I worked with the band, and I had a whole bunch of that other stuff and a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne because I wasn't drinking, damn it. You know, brilliant mind of the alcoholic. It licked my wounds the next day, and now I started going to 3-4 meetings a day. And I couldn't be left alone with myself. I was afraid that I was going to end up back at that bar again, and I was 47 years old, so I hung on to that right to get up and throw up every morning for a long time, man. And I started going to a lot of meetings, and I saw a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Scott Redman, my first sponsor. And I just liked the way he carried himself. And so we had our San Fernando Valley Convention. And God bless the ladies from Chandler Lodge. They saw how crushed up I was. And they really took care of me when I was brand new. And so I'm at the convention, and I'm out in the hallway. It's spiritual breakfast Sunday morning. And I didn't know that you needed a ticket to go to the spiritual breakfast. So the girls saw me out there, and I was about to explode a garden hose resentment out of my forehead because I couldn't get in. And they snuck one of the girls' tickets out and went to the ladies' room. And they snuck me back in. So every year since then, I've had to make amends to that convention, and I love it. But thank God, we sat in the back of the room. There was 3,000, 4,000 drunks in that grand ballroom. And right in front of me was a table with that man that I'd seen around Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. I went up and asked that man, and he reluctantly said, I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. And I don't know if I have time to take you on. And I know that his wife gave him a shot. She said, you better sponsor this guy. He looks like he really wants it. God bless Nancy. And Scott says, all right, I'll sponsor you, but here's what I want you to do. I want you to call me every day for 7 days. And if you miss a day, we're going to have to start all over again. I can do that. I want this bad enough. And he said, and I'd also like you to get up in the morning and say this very simple prayer. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable. But I know you'll restore me to sanity. So today I'm yours. Okay, so we're getting to know each other. I'd get up every morning. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable. I know you'll restore me to sanity. I'm yours. Things are going pretty good. I'm not thinking about drinking. I'm not doing any of that other goofy stuff. Now I'm starting to see guys that aren't sticking around. I said, wait a minute. That's scary. It took me 47 years to get here, man. If I listen now and I drink again, I may never find my way back. So I said, actually, I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that one of my character defects is I'm a retaliator. If you get me, I'm going to get you back. So some old timer got in my face and said, kid, you'll never do a fourth step. You'll drink before you do. So I had to show him back, right? So I called Scott up and I said, hey man, I want to do this fourth step. He said, perfect timing. So we booked, set up a time to come. I came up to his house. I really think that that was the day that my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started. A kitchen table, a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, pot of coffee if you're lucky, and one drunk talking to another. Now, if you see the situation with one guy sitting by himself talking to him, that's not so good. He needs some help, so go eat. But that one drunk talking to another. So he said, let me go through chapter 5 with you, and if there's something you don't understand, let's talk about it. So he opened the big book, and he read to me. And he got through the A, B's, and C's, the three pertinent ideas that God could and would if sought. That's the bottom line here, folks. Don't even have to find them. God could and would if sought. That's why we're all here. He read on after the three pertinent ideas. And he said, now I'll show you how this inventory stuff works. So he said, get some paper out. All right. Draw a line across the top and a line down each side about an inch in. And at the top, write resentment. I said, okay. So I did that. And he looked over at me and said, do you have any resentments? I said, geez, not that I can think of. I said, well, what about that guy in England that screwed you out of all that money? Oh, yeah, him. Put his name down. So I put his name down. The next column was, why did you have this resentment? What was the cause of the resentment? So I said, well, he promised me pay for work. I worked. He didn't pay. Good. So now I got the cause down. Then the next column was, how did you having this resentment, how did it affect you? I said, what do you mean? I was on top of the heap in New York. I went to work with this guy. And now my life's in shambles. He said, wait a minute. He's not doing this. You're the drunk here. How did you having the resentment? So he said, look on the bottom of page 64 of our beautiful big book. He said, my family calls it SPAPS, self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relationship, and sex. He said, did you having that relationship, did it affect your self-esteem? Yep, I'm a loser. Did it affect your pocketbook? Were you listening? Did it affect your ambition? Yeah, maybe the next band I'm in, I'm going to get screwed again. Did it affect your personal relationships? I said, well, this man, I couldn't say his name without a nasty word behind it. Did it affect your sex? I said, everything does. He goes, great, you got a five-bagger there. You know, if your self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relationship, and sex are tied up in a resentment, you're kind of busy. You're kind of busy being angry, you know. So I'm starting to see the gist of this thing. Then came the best part. He said, now turn that page over, and I want you to write at the top, what is the fault in Denny that if God would come along and remove it, he would no longer have this resentment? I went, wait a minute, you know, this isn't fair. This just isn't right. It's not. So he said, look, you're the drunk here. You're the one taking this inventory. Let's be tough on you, maybe for the first time in your life. So I said, okay, I'm working without a contract. There's a bunch of money here not coming my way. I don't have a contract. I guess that would make me irresponsible. So there's my first character defect. I'm irresponsible. I let it happen. You know, let me get back to that. You know, this disease, there's two things that motivate this disease, self and fear. When I'm not thinking about myself, I'm thinking about myself. And I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, fancy to real. So if I don't have a real one, I'll make it up. You know, I'm just more comfortable in that state. So here I'm looking at, okay, I'm irresponsible. Yeah, okay, I cop to that. And it's usually because I'm afraid. I'm afraid to go to the guy and talk about it, which fear of confrontation. When I'm in fear of confrontation, then my alcoholic brain kicks in. I know how to handle this. Just freeze him right out of your life. Go to silent scorn. There's another good character defect. Now I'm in silent scorn, and I said, well, why don't I just mess with the guy a little bit? So I go to emotional blackmail and character assassination. Then I'm on a roll. And that's the way resentment just kept me drinking. So now I'm learning so much about myself through one example on this dang fourth step. I think that first, well, the only fourth step that I did took 5 or 8 months. It took a little while, but it's funny how every time I would put an entry in that book, I felt a little bit better about my path, and I really felt like I was getting my uniform and getting into the game of AA. So I spent he showed me, the next was the fear list, you know, told me about fancy to real, we're driven by 100 forms of fear. One of my favorite lines in the big book, when it says, when we ask God to remove this fear, favorite line, it says, immediately we commence to outgrow the fear. That's a pretty good deal, because I was all wrapped in my fears. Okay, that's the second list. The third list is a sexual inventory. And, you know, they put that on page 69, so it's easy for us to find, you know. But it's a beautiful inventory that you use every day in your life. Ask some simple questions. Where was I selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? How could I have unjustifiably aroused suspicion, bitterness, or jealousy? Easy. Selfish. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. Dishonest. Didn't tell her I was in marriage. She didn't speak English anyway. I was in Japan. Inconsiderate. I didn't care what anybody felt like in the morning when they got up. How could I have unjustifiably aroused suspicion, jealousy? You know, every time I left the house to go on a concert tour, my wife knew if I drank, anything was possible. So I had to get all of this stuff on paper. And what I'm doing is I'm getting all my resentments, my fears, and my sexual stuff together so I can bunch them, ball them all up, and hand them off to God. If I take my life out of my hands and I put it in God's hands, it's going to be fine. So it took the 5 to 8 months, whatever it was. Oh, I forgot the one of the best parts about that. When we first sat down, he read chapter 5, and then he got to page 63 where it talks about the third step prayer. He said, "Are you ready to take the formal third step?" And I said, "I'm very ready." He said, "I believe you are." So here's this man that I just met. We get on our knees and we locked arms and we took the third step formally. And I'm sure you guys know it, but it's so deep. It's so deep. "God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties." What are my difficulties? All of this garbage that I'm finding out about me in this four-step. Why? "So they may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life." So I'm learning so much about me, not who I thought I was, but who I really am. I got off my knees with that sponsor, and I felt like a miracle just happened. I would never have to drink again. I really felt like there was something special going on here. And I've sponsored a lot of men over my 28 years here. Every time I take a man through the third step and do the formal third step prayer with him, I know I have another day away from drinking. It's just the most amazing thing. So now I read my inventory to him. You know, he lay down on the couch. He might have dozed off a few times. We laughed, we cried, we hugged. And I felt like I'd taken a shower on the inside. And I opened up all of those wounds that used to keep me in that bar. And I knew that I'd never have to go back to them. But now, I had to come full circle and go make that right. I had to make amends. So I went back to Pennsylvania, to that little hometown of mine, where my family was deeply immersed in the church. And the first thing I do when traveling, where is the AA meeting? You guess where it is, in my church. So there I am in the church that I stole a few quarters from, in the nursery room that I was brought as a baby. And on the wall, there were 7 founding fathers of the church. My grandfather's picture was there. I had to make amends to my grandfather for the way I tended bar at his funeral. My family didn't have bars. We didn't drink. But when I was drinking, we had a bar at my grandfather's funeral. After that church service, I went up to the cemetery where my dad, my grandparents, and a few other family members were buried. And I walked up to those tombstones and just cried like a baby. Just so ashamed. So ashamed with the beautiful life I was given and how I messed it up over a beverage. Disgusted with myself, came home and realized I better get to work in AA. That's when I really started taking more commitments, sponsoring more men, getting more and more and more and more involved. So the amends made me feel good, but I knew there was a lot more to go. And then my mom called me up and said, "The doctors just diagnosed me with an aneurysm behind my heart in the aorta. They think it's dangerous. They want to do a surgery. I'm scared." I said, "Mom, if only you were an alcoholic, we have great ways of dealing with this fear." And so I told her what we do with our fear in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she started keeping a journal. And we talk every day. And I said, "Come on, Mom, you were raised in the church. You believe, you've strong faith. You can do this." She started doing it. It's time for the surgery, and I'll be damned if the doctors, some big team of doctors in Penn Hospital or something in Philly, they had to move the surgery 30 days. So now she's in absolute terror. And I had to give her the best that you guys give me on a daily basis. Got her ready again, flew home for the surgery. Unfortunately, she didn't make it through the surgery. It was too bad. She was 74 years old. So it was quite a shock. It was a brutal way to end. The next day we're up at the house and getting ready to plan the funeral and everything. And I found her journal. And in her journal, she said how his son, her son, and his wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous made the last days of her life so much better than they would have been. I'm way overpaid here for the heartache that I caused on that poor woman. So that night, I was the last night with my mom in the funeral home, and I had my 5-year medallion. I put my 5-year medallion in her hand, and I closed her hand, and then closed the coffin. Don't want to go back to that way of life. I want to remember where I left that coin. And yesterday, Don and I were over at Dr. Bob's grave, and he took his 15-year coin and my 28-year coin. We know where they are. We know where they are, Dr. Bob's grave. God bless them. What an incredible thing to do, though, to be able to make amends to a parent, you know? So I'm coming home from that experience feeling pretty good about life, feeling pretty good about the choices that I've made. Now I realize, gee, now I got to make amends to that guy in England that screwed me out of all of the money, and I can't ask for the check. So that was hard. It was hard. And as I said earlier, Dr. Paul O became my grand sponsor, and I worked with Paul on this because the resentment used to keep popping up. I did my fourth step. I thought I was over it, but a little while later, this resentment would pop up again. So Paul led me to a book called Sermon on the Mount. And on page 178 of Sermon on the Mount is a prayer of forgiveness. And after, he said, you've done all your work in AA. Why don't you try this, see if it gives you some relief? So check out this book, Sermon on the Mount. I believe it's AA approved as well. It's just great stuff. But that prayer of forgiveness gave me a lot of peace, a lot of peace. And that resentment didn't run me anymore. It didn't run me to the bar, for sure. So I'm getting a lot of peace. Now, I turn on the television one day, and I see that guy from England that screwed me out of all that money. His wife died. And I hadn't talked to him since I left the band many years. Immediately upon seeing that he lost his wife to breast cancer, I picked up the phone and called him. I said, where did that come from? Is this me? So I called him, we talked, and it was beautiful. It was. We were invited to a memorial for his wife they had in New York City, and I said to my wife, we better go, it's part of my amends. So we flew into New York thinking they wouldn't even know we're there, the family wouldn't know. And we were marched up the front of the church, we sat across from the family. And afterwards, we talked. I realized that my amends were understood and accepted. Amends. The promises only come through when we're halfway through our amends. So anyway, I'm feeling pretty good about this, and I said to my wife, let's go to England and see how he's doing without his long-term partner like we were, just to see how he's doing. So we get over there to England to see how he's doing. We're hanging out, having a good time. And he says, you know what? I think we're going to reissue the early music you did with the band, the beginning days of the band. We're going to put it out again. We're going to make a movie about it, a documentary. I said, great idea. What can I do to help? Did I just say that? So anyway, he said, you used to have a little video camera back in the dressing rooms, candid stuff. Could we use that on the film? And I said, absolutely. So I get home and I send him the footage, and he sends me a little check. I was, hey, this is great. I didn't have to ask for it, you know. So I'm saying to myself, wow, this is really cool. This stuff works. Now I'm starting to see promotion on this project that it's coming out soon. And I said, wait a minute. This ain't right here. I called my buddy at the record company. I said, what's this thing going to sell? He said, well, we're not sure, but we're shipping 2 million units tomorrow. I went, oh, no. I can't watch this money go by again. And I'd had a new sponsor by now. So I call my sponsor. I said, what do I do? He says, there's only one thing to do, and that's to write a letter. I said, wait a minute. I made a deal with God. I said, hey, man, don't let me drink again, and I don't care if I ever see another penny from those days. So he said, well, that's your choice, but you got to remember, God's old, and he moves slow. So I said, all right, okay, I get it. You know, you want to move a mountain, bring a shovel. So I start writing this letter. He says it was about 15 drafts till I got the poison out of it. I think it was 3 or 4. But, you know, I got to say what I needed to say in a loving way to a wrecked relationship. And as I did that, I would read it to my sponsor every time. And the last time I read it, he said, I think you said what you needed to say. Why don't you see what God's got to say about it? So I talked to God for a little bit. God said, yeah, send that letter. So if you're ever going to do an amends letter, make sure to read it to your sponsor first. It always helps. So I sent this letter off with God's blessing. I know that the man opened the letter, read the letter, picked up the phone in tears. He said, Denny, I'm so sorry. I had no idea my business people rolled over you that way. I am so sorry. We talked. Finally, at the end of that conversation, he said, I'm going to make this right. Wow. He said, by the way, how did you live with that for 28 years? I said, well, I'm an AA. Wasn't that easy, you know? I know I called my wife at work that day, and she screamed. Everybody in the office thought somebody died in the family. It was like a 28-year weight being lifted off of our shoulders. Through doing a little simple work in our program, following some suggestions, oh my God, I was free. We're great friends today. I must say, we're great friends. He understands my path, and I understand his path, you know. It's a miracle that the very thing that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous came full circle. All of the lives affected by it, all the relationships, all the financial burdens, everything wound up fixed. Because I had nothing to do with it, I'm following this guy. He's telling me what to do. So Dr. Paul always used to end his talks. I love this about him. He used to say, if you're here tonight, I hope you have a great case of alcoholism. Because alcoholism is the only disease known to mankind. When you catch it, you become a better person. Pretty cool, huh? And all we have to do to keep it, give it away. That's what I'm doing tonight. And all this disease insists of us. It insists that we be happy, joyous, and free. I still had some bar tabs in the beginning down there in San Fernando Valley, but I figured it out over time. Happy, joyous, and free is a life free of resentment, fears, and unsolvable sexual problems. It's that damn fourth step. That's why they talk about it in the big book as building an archway through which we pass a free man. That's my story. I passed through that archway. If you would have told me 28 years ago that my life was going to be like it is today, I would have said, you got the wrong guy, pal. So I love you all for sitting and listening to me ramble about the thing that's the most profound thing that's ever happened in my life. I'm honored that you would ask me to come and talk to you. And going around, at least I didn't break down 15 times like I did when I was going from Dr. Bob's house to the Mayflower to the Gatehouse. So I'm thrilled and honored to be here, and I love you all. Thanks for listening.